I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A new budget proposed by President Trump calls for billions to be added to military spending and border security, but would cut more than 15% from the Department of Agriculture. Today, a conversation about the president's proposal titled A Budget for a Better America. We'll ask what it could mean for farmers and agricultural communities across the country. Then, some say it's a man's world. Maybe that's because history has largely failed to acknowledge the women who have wielded power. We'll hear about the influence of some ancient female leaders in Egypt and learn the political lessons they have to teach us. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. President Donald Trump's latest budget proposal, which was released on Monday, made headlines because it calls for billions more to be spent on the military and building a border wall. But the budget also proposes some major changes to the federal government's farm programs. Just one example, President Trump's newest budget would cut more than $3 billion from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. To discuss the president's budget proposal and what it could mean for agricultural communities across the country, we're joined by Madeline Beck. She's a reporter for Harvest Public Media. That's a journalism collaboration based here at KCUR. Madeline joins us this morning from WILL in Urbana, Illinois. Madeline, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Good to be here.
For listeners who don't know, let's first explain what the president's budget really is, because it's not the law of the land, and it very likely won't become law. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, when it comes to the president's budget, it's a wish list to Congress, some of the things that he wants implemented in this next year. And it will likely never be passed completely as any president asks it to be. But this particular budget is already seeing pushback from congressional representative Republicans. So there's likely not much of it that's going to make it through 100% as written.
So pushback already from Congress? I can't imagine pushback already from Congress. Yeah. Well, the title of this budget, and yes, they have titles these days. This one's A Budget for a Better America, Promises Kept, Taxpayers First. But does that strike you as an apt title? Because farm communities are going to be a little disappointed here, aren't they?
I mean, absolutely. There's going to be a lot of disappointment, specifically with different parts that are going to be cut. There is going to be some hope when it comes to more funding for different things like ag research, but other things that we're about to discuss, I'm sure, are going to see massive cuts like crop insurance, that sort of thing.
What has the president's message been to farm country the past few months? What's he been saying?
I mean, over the past few years, he's been incredibly supportive, vocally supportive of farm country, of rural Americans. He's also been trying to assuage them of fears when it comes to some of the trade issues with China that we've been watching. And so he's been really trying to make sure that they understand what's going on with him, or trying to, that he's trying to be on their side. But when it comes to this budget, that there's some things that most farmers are not going to be a fan of, especially just parts of the budget.
You know, do people you talk to out in farm country, do they think President Trump has their best interests at heart? Or do you think this budget proposal will change how they feel about him and what he wants to do?
Well, there's that old saying that applies to a lot of things, but you've talked to one farmer and you've talked to one farmer. Everybody is different. So I just yesterday, I've talked to two different farmers, one of whom was very critical and didn't think that President Trump has their best interest in mind. And then the other one had the exact opposite. We're like, oh, you know, mistakes were made, but we do believe he really, in the end, wants to help us. So it's really variable across the board.
Okay, let's get into some numbers here just a little bit. I already mentioned this $3.6 billion cut the president proposed to the Department of Agriculture. Give us some perspective on how big of a cut is that, really?
That's 15% of the entire budget for USDA.
Wow.
So that is
wow.
A big cut.
Yeah.
That's going to affect programs across the board if it were to be implemented as proposed.
The administration wants to limit who can get crop insurance subsidies. You've mentioned that and how big those payments can be. This seems like a pretty big deal because many farmers depend on that insurance whenever a crop fails. What changes are being proposed there?
So there's a few key changes. And if you look in the budget itself, there's limit crop insurance eligibility. And that's to about $500,000 of adjusted gross income per farm manager. And so what that basically means is people making more won't be eligible for subsidized crop insurance. There's also going to be cuts to crop insurance premium subsidies across the board. And there's going to be less payments and gains going to crop insurance companies. So there's cuts all over the place when it comes to crop insurance.
Help me understand that. So is that aimed primarily then at these big industrial farms? They wouldn't get as much money if a crop fails?
Well, the first and the third thing that I said would. So the limiting the crop insurance eligibility would and capping the insurance company's gains would. But when it comes to reducing crop insurance premium subsidies across the board, that's going to hurt everybody. And that's going to be the big deal that already staunch Republicans in the Senate are already pretty much denouncing.
Why does the administration want to go in this direction? Do you have any sense of what the thinking is?
Well, there's been rumblings in a lot of especially sectors around Congress that don't have to do with agriculture about there being too much subsidization of farmers.
You hear that a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, outside of farm country, of course, but that there's been too much subsidization. But when you break it down to crop insurance to a single farm, I hung out with a farmer down in Jerseyville about this time last year and he walked me through how much he'd bought in crop insurance. So he got up to about 90% of his crops were covered. So what that means is he could have a complete crop failure and still make 90% of that money back. And that might seem like a lot, but if you're a farmer paying millions in and getting millions back, but only $200,000 making overall,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
If you lose more than 10% on what you've spent, that could be millions of dollars real fast or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that could put a farm out of business real fast.
So bottom line, how big a change would this be compared to how things are run now?
I mean, that would be complete. We would have to see. I mean, this would be big cuts, and there's certain parts of farm country that might be able to handle it, others not. But again, I don't think this particular part will be implemented.
How much money are they estimating that would be saved by this change to crop insurance subsidies?
So if you're looking at all the different crop insurance subsidy changes, that's about $25.8 billion.
Wow. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. No, that's definitely a significant chunk of change. And that still is over about between 2020 and 2029. So that's a decade. But still.
There's a $3.1 billion line item here that caught your attention as well, Madeline, and understandably so. It's called Streamline Conservation Programs. Any idea what that means?
I mean, that could have a range of meanings. We've seen a lot of different changes that have been asked for by the Trump administration and cabinet officials just about how red tape from these programs and then just that they can be abused by certain organizations. One of the biggest ones that they'll be going after is the Conservation Reserve Program. That's the biggest one. And so they will likely be going after that, which pays farmers to set aside some more environmentally important property to grow it for wildlife habitat and to prevent soil erosion, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Again, you've heard complaints about those kinds of programs over the years as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just people outside of farm country for that one. There are people who are actually using the Conservation Reserve Program who believe that there are certain changes that could be made. But with this kind of cuts, that would be not just a few changes, but that would be some pretty significant cuts to the reach of this program.
You know, if our listeners want to join our conversation, you're welcome to do so. We're talking about President Trump's proposed budget, how it would affect farm country. Our number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I'm visiting with Madeline Beck this morning from WILL in Urbana, Illinois. She's a reporter with Harvest Public Media. You know, one thing that strikes me as odd is we're talking about these big changes to these farm programs, and we just went through the rewriting of the Farm Bill, which is a bill that, unlike a lot of bills, has a shelf life of several years. Why are we going through this big conversation now just on the heels of having dealt with the Farm Bill?
A lot of people are asking that question.
Okay, it's a good question.
It is. It's an excellent question, and it's one that Republicans, especially in the Senate, are also asking. You have, I mean, Pat Roberts, from Kansas.
Yeah.
So he sent out a response, and just to quote him, he said, just quote, "Now is not the time to be making changes to the vital risk management tools that are essential to producers in order to withstand this tough period in the agriculture economy. We must first allow the Farm Bill to be fully implemented." He was one of the leaders in making sure the Farm Bill passed the Senate and passed the House. He was making sure that these programs were in place so farmers had certainty, which they really need when financially planning. This was something that held up the Farm Bill and had a lapse in funding for the Farm Bill. And that just got signed in December by Trump. And now he's going and saying that these programs, actually, I also want to change this year. So that has a lot of people scratching their heads.
I was going to say, Pat Roberts has got to be incredulous here.
Yeah. It does appear so.
Yeah, yeah. Phone number here, if our listeners want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Madeline, we were talking about conservation programs here. What can you tell us about how the president has treated conservation programs in his first 2 years? I mean, does that give you any clue of what to expect going forward here?
I mean, mainly his role has been trying to, one, cut red tape, and two, help industry. And industry has a lot of concerns about different conservation requirements in general. And conservation programs, they said, are either overused or are wasteful spending in certain ways, that they can be streamlined, that sort of thing. And I think the Trump administration has really been pushing on making sure industry has access to as most places as possible to promote economic growth as much as possible. And so I think that we're going to see more of that no matter what. We're going to see more promotion of industry. That's been a hardline part of his just what he's run on. And so that's, I mean, if you're asking what we're going to expect, we're just going to expect more of that.
So that means what for agriculture then?
That's going to mean dual things for agriculture. Like I said, with the Conservation Reserve Program, some farmers do rely on at least some of their income coming from that. Mm-hmm. And so they won't be as impressed with this, especially with the crop insurance. But at the same time, they are happy to hear about different, they want less emission standards on their tractors and equipment, right? Because those are expensive. So you're going to have people on either side of the issue on this one.
You know, more from the income column of this budget, Madeline, you note there are five programs listed that will bring in cash by way of new user fees. That seems a little vague.
Yes. No, it definitely does. We were taking a look at those, and there have been other proposals when it comes to user fees, when they're talking about, like, tobacco product user fees and when it comes to marketing and things like that from the U.S. government. But with these, it's like established food safety and inspection service user fee. Does that mean the company that will need food safety and inspection done has to pay that fee in order to operate? Where will that be passed on to? Will companies be able to take it on, or will it be passed on to the consumer? There are a lot of questions that we have.
and for some people, those questions are questions with big dollar signs attached to them.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So that would be under the Food Safety and Inspection Service. The Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service would have a user fee. Packers and Stockyards Program, there would be a new user fee. Agriculture Marketing Service, user fee. So there's all of these that are coming up that we're looking at these potential user fees, and we would definitely like more information on those.
Another cut the president is proposing. He wants to eliminate the Food for Progress program, estimated to save about $160 million. What is the Food for Progress program?
Okay, so what it does is it helps developing countries and emerging democracies modernize and strengthen their agriculture sectors, basically. And so we donate agriculture commodities to recipient countries that are sold on their market, and the money from that is specifically used to help them bolster their agriculture overall. And so that's, they help train farmers in animal and plant health. They help them with new and improved farming methods and do all of this. And it's a program that's bred goodwill in a lot of countries that are developing. And it, at the same time, it gets us a place to ship more of our agriculture goods and could potentially make a market for not only our agriculture goods, but later, as they develop, maybe some of our agriculture technology.
Some folks listening to this might be thinking, why in the world will we be sending that kind of money overseas for that kind of purpose?
Right. And it's twofold. There is the goodwill part, but there's also the part of, we would be building out our market for agriculture products, agriculture technology, and as we help economies grow, growing economies are going to be buying more technology. And the United States is a leader in high technology right now. So we are essentially putting a down payment on something that could grow into something that makes us more money in the long run. And in some of these communities, it might not turn out to be that way. But that's the hope for a lot of people, that this is a program for the long run. But at the same time, like you said, people are, and especially a lot of the Trump administration's policies have said, you know, why help that money for later on when we should be spending it on more immediate things now? And what he's been saying is wall funding and military funding.
Hmm. Talk to us about America's Harvest Box. What is that, and what does Trump want to do with it?
Well, this is the second budget in a row that the Trump administration has proposed that has this harvest box. And it's described in the last budget, especially, was shelf-stable milk, ready-to-eat cereals, pasta, peanut butter, beans, canned meats, and canned fruits and vegetables. Nothing particularly fresh. That would be very difficult. But basically, we would be sending these boxes of food to Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program recipients, or SNAP recipients, or formerly known as food stamps. And they would have to take up about half of the, well, what it was proposed as the last budget is it would be about half of what they would eat or get as their nutritional assistance.
Hmm. One of the issues people had with this program when it was proposed last year, if I recall right, was that SNAP recipients would have limited ability to choose the food they wanted sent to them, right?
That's correct. Absolutely. And I guess one other thing I should mention is all that food through the Trump administration, it was from the U.S. So that was U.S. grown and produced food. That was a big point for the Trump administration.
And are there other objections to this whole idea of America's Harvest Box, Madeline?
Oh, absolutely. And the biggest objection from both sides of the aisle is economics. If you have a box filled with canned goods and even powdered milk, that's going to be a heavy box. Shipping that to people around the United States, about 40 million people on average were on SNAP this last year. So that's a lot of households, a lot of boxes.
Man.
That's a lot. That's expensive.
Yeah, right. The latest farm bill, again, the one that passed last year, kicked off this fight over work requirements for SNAP recipients. Those work requirements are making an appearance in this budget proposal after they were sort of fought off last year. Tell us about that.
So, yeah, this has been an ongoing discussion, and it's around a group of people called ABODs is what they've been referred to in Congress, but adults without disabilities and without dependents. And so these are adults who are on the food stamp program that are getting food that the Trump administration and others are saying, you know, we should get them working instead. And the issue that people have taken with that is some of these people have undiagnosed severe mental health issues. And, you know, they might be in a job market where there isn't a job that they can get. So if you impose a work requirement for them to get food, the biggest argument that we've heard is that they're not going to be able to get food because there's just not a job there. And they don't have the money to move. And so there's that. But at the same time, there are, on the Republican side especially, they're like, you know, these people will still have a few months on the food, and we want to help them. The way they've put it in the budget is we want to help them get into the workforce by paying for training programs. And then the biggest issue with that is training program, pilot programs that are out there haven't proved themselves yet. There isn't enough information to say whether they actually work in getting these folks into the workforce. Huh. So that's where things are at right now. There's also the Agriculture Secretary, Sonny Perdue, does have is trying to do this by himself and through the USDA. And there is a proposal right now on the Federal Register that is open for public comments on just doing that himself, imposing those work requirements.
You know, not everything in this budget has been cut. You note that the president wants to give the Agriculture and Food Research Initiative, again, I'll be curious to know what that is, about $85 million more than it got last year. Tell us about that program and why it might need a funding boost here.
So yeah, that's and the Trump administration has been very interested in that because it's a competitive grant program. So it thrives on competition, and out of competition comes new ideas and new technology that the United States could benefit from, especially if you're going to export it to other countries that are developing their ag programs. So what it is it's just the Agriculture and Food Research Initiative that. Like it's USDA's flagship competitive grant program, and it helps around the nation basically bring together scientists and researchers, and they'll get grants to modernize the food and agriculture system. This increase in funding would be massive for those who are supporting ag research. There's actually a group called Supporters of Agriculture Research that sent me a press release applauding the decision. They had been pushing for this. Basically, AFRI, as it's called colloquially, was authorized $700 million in the three past farm bills in 2008, 2014, and 2018. But it's never received that full amount of funding. And so in enacted 2019 levels, it was closer to $400 million. So this budget requests $500 million. And so even though that's not the amount that would be full funding, which would, you know, be $700 million, it's way closer to that. So research groups are way behind this.
Yeah, you know, as we wrap this thing up, might all these changes result in higher grocery bills for consumers? Can you make that leap based on what you know right now?
I can't make that leap yet.
Yeah, okay.
Like I said, this is there's too many variables and there's too little certainty that any of this will make it through Congress as it's written. The one thing that people are watching for their grocery bills is more what's going on with trade internationally. And we're all watching that.
Okay, that's Madeline Beck. She's a reporter for Harvest Public Media. That's a journalism collaborative based here at KCUR. Madeline, great job. Thanks for taking some time and explaining all that to us. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Have a good one.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back here, we'll talk about a time when women ruled the world. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, Kansas City mayoral candidate and Councilman Quentin Lucas shared his proposals for development east of Troost, public health, streetcars, and more. Hear that conversation and other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with the new Secretary of the Kansas Department of Children and Families. That's Laura Howard. She's tasked with turning around the embattled child welfare agency. We'll ask about the changes she thinks are needed. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, once upon a time, women ruled the world. They did so from their homes in Egypt and wielded power and influence that is undeniable. And yet history books have long overlooked this era of women in power. One reason for that may be because they were considered exceptions to the rule, little more than political pawns in a male-dominated society. Some of their names are familiar, Cleopatra and Nefertiti. Others are more obscure. But it's a time worth considering, and Kara Cooney does that for us in her book, When Women Ruled the World. Kara Cooney is a professor of Egyptology at UCLA. She'll be in town to speak on Tuesday evening at a National Geographic Presents program at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. And she joins us now from NPR West in Culver City, California. It's nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
How could the history books, Kara, possibly overlook a development like this, this idea of women ruling the world for extended periods, and yet that hasn't been included very, very much in the books?
Well, the ancient Egyptians got a jump on us, so we can't blame it all on ourselves. The ancient Egyptians would erase many of these women a couple of generations after they ruled. And if they're taking them out of their own formal history books, then you know, we wouldn't know about them either.
Why would they do that?
Well, there's this one woman named Hatshepsut of Dynasty 18, and she did such a good job ruling Egypt on behalf of her dynasty, saving the reign of her nephew, leaving Egypt better than she found it. As soon as there was another direction for this patriarchal kingship, it was easier for them to remove her name and replace it with the names of other men, to take all of her success and give it to those who came after her, those who came before her. And so we can't even pronounce the name Hatshepsut anymore.
Was there a sense of embarrassment in a male-dominated world that a woman could have that much success?
Embarrassment, you know, this is something that really gets to the heart of our own ongoing human hostility towards females in power, something that I try to get to the heart of every time I teach women in power in the ancient world at UCLA. It's something that I still don't completely understand, that I think has a lot more evolutionary biology in it than we'd like to admit. But the ancient Egyptians, like most human beings on this planet, if not all in complex societies, like to see power move through a patriarchal line from father to son to grandson. Maybe we don't all work with kingships, and maybe some of us work with democracies and more complicated and broadly based power systems, but we generally like to choose men to be in charge of our politics or our money or our religions.
And women disrupted the regular order of things, it sounds like.
Yes, but here's the cool and interesting thing. The ancient Egyptians seem to have known that women could rule differently, and that's why they picked them again and again, regularly, systematically, to act as regents for boy kings who were too young to make decisions on their own, because choosing the kid's mother or the kid's aunt would lessen warlording and competition. Because think about it, if the kid's uncle came in and acted as his advisor, then you're in a risky position. That man could come in and assassinate the young king and then take the power for himself, whereas the kid's mother's not going to do that. So Egypt trusted women to keep their authoritarian regime safe.
But what time periods are we talking about here, roughly, Kara?
That's the coolest part, too. It's from the very beginnings, from Dynasty 1 all the way to the very bitter end in Cleopatra when Egypt is taken into the grasp of the Roman Empire. So it's female power is really the other side of the coin of kingship for Egypt from the very beginnings to the very end.
How tough was it for you to, you know, to go back and unearth more information about these women leaders from so long ago, particularly when much of their history had been so intentionally erased?
Well, I'm standing on the shoulders of a number of other Egyptologists who have done very careful work for these women in different times of history. I can't be a specialist of Dynasty 1 and Dynasty 18 simultaneously. These are thousands of years apart. Mm-hmm. But I rely on scholars who are very carefully checking the traces of what names and images were there before the chisels were brought to stone. And careful epigraphic work, careful examination of stones, careful gluing together of statues, these things can help resurrect and resuscitate what has been erased.
So how did it come to pass that these women found themselves in positions of such vast power? What allowed that to happen back in the day?
In each case, it's a little bit different, but almost every woman finds their path as a regent for a king who is too young to rule on his own. There are situations where a woman comes to power because it seems there's no male at all, young or old. And I would put that blame, that onus on incest more than anything else. And that could be Dynasty 12 and a queen named Neferu Sobek who became king. The key question to ask is, why does a queen become king? And you probably are asking yourself, well, why is she using the word king?
Right.
And I do say female king. The ancient Egyptians didn't use the word queen to connote rule. For them, that just meant a sexual helpmate of the king. The word king was used by them when one of these women attained the highest leader of state position. And so that's the word that I use.
You know, one thing I'm confused about, this notion we've talked about here of some of these histories being erased when women ruled. You know, at the time, Egypt had these laws, Kara, that created a social system that was, you know, it was more balanced, a little more equally between men and women. And I'm surprised, you know, given the fact there was some degree of parity, that erasing the traces of these women leaders was sort of the route that was taken.
Yeah, because you want to support that patriarchal lineage. And, you know, we talk a lot about propaganda today and how a government creates an idealized and perfected look to its leaders. And the ancient Egyptians excelled at this. The females came in generally during a time period of crisis. And it was that crisis they were erasing as much as the female. But I will also say that we haven't erased the females who are failures, and I would include Cleopatra in that lineage. We remember her as a cautionary tale, perhaps as a reason that women shouldn't rule. Shakespeare has written a play about her. Hmm. Everybody can pronounce the name Cleopatra and knows more or less what her story is.
Right.
And so we as human beings do enjoy keeping the stories of the women who got it all wrong and repeating those again and again, and I need to ask myself and ask all of us, why?
Well, why did Egypt evolve the way it did when it came to, you know, giving more clout to women who were seen as the weaker sex?
There's an uncomfortable truth to this as well, and it took me a long time to figure this out. But Egypt is this strange and protected place, protected on all four sides geographically, that it doesn't allow a lot of invasion from outside, and there's not a lot of warlording on the inside. And this is a place that is so interested in the status quo and safety of its kings that it develops a perfected divine kingship unlike anywhere else on the planet. And so in this most authoritarian, most unequal of social situations, pyramidal, if you like, this is where the women come in to protect that system. The more the power is held in this unequal way within the hands of a family, the more a woman can come in and act on behalf of her son, on behalf of her nephew, on behalf of her husband, to protect that patriarchal lineage. In other places in the ancient world, like Greece or Rome, where power was more broadly distributed and there was more warlording and more competition, when one man fell, another man took his place, and women had no shot to really claim real power. It was only in those authoritarian kingships where women could step in with real unadulterated power and formally take the position, at least five times, of king.
That's interesting. Kara Cooney is my guest. She's a professor of Egyptology out at UCLA, and she's the author of a book from 2018, When Women Ruled the World. She'll be speaking Tuesday at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts about that topic. This is a National Geographic event. For tickets, go to events.nationalgeographic.com. How big a deal was Egypt back in those days? How powerful was Egypt across the globe then?
If we're talking about dynasties 1 through 18, or even up to dynasty 20, Egypt was the most powerful game in town. Hmm. It had the best standing army. It was rich in terms of gold and other mineral wealth. And its grain, it grew easily without too much labor. It was able to grow all kinds of wheat and barley and produce beer beyond measure. It was an extraordinarily wealthy place.
So when women took over in Egypt during these different times, how did people react to that?
It's hard to say. I mean, this is an authoritarian regime. It's not like we can go to Kim Jong-un's North Korea and say, hey, people, what do you think of this guy?
How's this working for you?
Exactly. So, you know, the ancient Egyptian situation was not much different. And everyone in authoritarian regimes knows that you don't complain about your leader. We assume that people would have left traces of what they thought and felt because we're so used to what Greece and Rome have given us in terms of its political legacy. But ancient Egypt was very different, which makes my job as a historian that much more complicated because I really do have to pull the veils away from the idealized image that these kings are giving us and try to find the real story, whatever that could be.
How frustrating is that for you as an Egyptologist?
It's very annoying. People ask all the time, you know, who were the lovers of Hatshepsut, or what did Merneith think of human sacrifice in the first dynasty? And I have no answers to these things. I can hypothesize, I can surmise, but some things ancient Egyptians are going to give us answers for, but most of those human details they do not. And that's why in my trade publications, in that work, I try to humanize these ancient Egyptian monarchs as much as possible. They're human just like you or me, and we would be drinking the Egyptian Kool-Aid if we put them on a pedestal and thought of them as god kings. That's exactly what they want us to do.
If you have questions for Kara Cooney and When Women Ruled the World, our number 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. How fair is it to conclude that, hey, you know, we tried this once, a world with women leaders, and we didn't go back to it, so we're slow to try it again? Is there anything to that?
I think that what we're doing now and what we're going through is a change at a very elemental level of our ideological, economic, and political systems. And by that, I mean women are slowly and inexorably taking on more power. There are only 6% female CEOs in the United States right now. Okay, great. But there are more female breadwinners, and women are starting to out-earn men in college degrees. Mm-hmm. As those landscapes change, female power will change. Women don't feel like they need to have children the way that they did when my mother was growing up, or even myself. And getting a job is not something that means you sacrifice family. And as women jump in with both feet into this world, the landscape will change. It will shift. We will allow women back into positions of power. And I often compare it to going back to our hunter-gatherer days of allowing women more equal access to power in our politics and religion.
Do we know what other civilizations thought about these women rulers?
There's not a lot there either. You know, what we do have, and this is very problematic, are the ancient Romans talking about Cleopatra in a very orientalizing way, a very denigrating way, talking about her authoritarianism in the most horrific of terms, and telling us how she destroyed two good Roman men, not just one, Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, and twisted them with her witchcraft and her sorcery. So we do know what some Western-minded, democracy-minded, or at least oligarchy-minded people thought of ancient Egypt. And it colors our own idea of how systems of government should work. I will say this, though I'm proud to live in a democracy and I happily vote in every election, it's an interesting thing that the oligarchic system of Rome, in which power was more broadly distributed, was much more costly for its people in terms of human lives and warlording than anything in ancient Egypt, which was a much safer, more status quo kind of existence. And if people have a chance to pick, this is one reason why people choose authoritarianism over democracy.
Oh, as you look back over the rules of these different women, do any commonalities emerge in terms of the types of leaders they were and what they were able to bring to their countries?
In each case, they come into power because there is some sort of a crisis. So in each case, they're, in a sense, on the back foot. And they have to be, most of them, more conservative, trying to figure out what the traditional path forward might be, not throwing their weight around, not making overt claims. Now, one might say, well, that's how women have to be in the workplace today, that you can't go out there, you know, with all of this hostility that people will then call you all kinds of words and make sure that you're seen as too aggressive, that you have to be more conservative, laugh more, make jokes, be softer in your way of using power. I'm sure these Egyptian women knew the same ways that we do, that people perceive your power, and they treaded very carefully from all that we can see.
Because you point out in here, and you just alluded to it, that these women were put into power by an Egyptian system that needed her rule, and they needed her rule because the country was having a hard time.
Yeah, in some cases, it's because the kid was too young to rule on his own. I have a 9-year-old at home. God help me if I decide to let him make decisions on behalf of my household.
Yeah.
He would love it, but no. I mean, think of Egypt being ruled by a 9 or 10-year-old kid. And who better to keep that kid in line, divine though he is, than the kid's mother? And boy, my kid thinks he's divine sometimes. So you want to make sure that woman is able to step in and keep the best interests of the child at heart. Let him grow into his kingship, not compete with him for it. It's an interesting thing to see the women who ruled for their own children. They generally didn't take the kingship themselves. They generally melted back into the shadows and let the king, their son, take it. But if the woman ruled as a regent for a child, not her own son, her nephew, perhaps, like Hatshepsut of Dynasty 18, that one step removal is enough for the competition to set in. And Hatshepsut did have herself crowned in Thutmose III's year 7, and she ruled alongside him until her death. And what he thought of this, we have no idea.
Wow. You also point out, and you've alluded to this too, that they could be seeing these women leaders as mere placeholders for male leaders who were too old, too young to rule. To what extent does that undermine all of this?
Well, they're not there to create a legacy. I mean, let me bring up some basic biological facts of kingship. Putting a man at the center of the wheel of power makes biological economic sense because a man can have 365 babies outside of his body in a given year with a good harem system that intensifies his biological production. That's basic biological economics. Mm-hmm. A woman at the center of that wheel of power can produce one, maybe two, if she has twins and lives through it, babies a year. And so all of a sudden, your status quo is going to be threatened. Your risk aversion is going to be threatened. And so putting a woman into that center of the wheel of power lessens your ability to create a genetic legacy. And that's the other reason these women are forgotten, because once a woman takes power, I would argue that in most cases, she is past childbearing years, or she's towards the, and we're talking about the ancient world when she's probably in her late 20s, God help us all. But she's not there producing children the way that a man does, and her ability to create a legacy is also stymied by what man is she going to bring into the situation? A lover? A new husband? Well, then that man's going to take control alongside her. So like Elizabeth I, many of these women, whether they could have babies or not, pretended to be virgin queens or did not have any offspring of their own.
So was it harder for these women to hold on to power than their male counterparts?
It was harder for them not to hold on to power, I would argue, but to create a legacy of long-term power that they passed on to a daughter or a son. And without that legacy, you have no dynasty. And then the power goes to somebody else entirely. Maybe to somebody within their line one step over, but that's even more reason to erase the woman, right? Because you want it to seem like it's passing perfectly in a divine sense from father to son. And this woman coming in, though you need her at the time, you've got to keep the authoritarian regime going. It complicates that whole divine succession, and it becomes easier to then remove her from the history books after her reign. It can take a couple of generations before you remove her, but if she is successful, removed she will be.
Kara Cooney is my guest. Her book, When Women Ruled the World, she'll be in town 7:30 Tuesday evening at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. She'll be talking about When Women Ruled the World. This is a National Geographic event. Tickets, events.nationalgeographic.com. So let's bring this into present day realities here, if we can, Kara, what conclusions have you drawn about why societies have remained so ultimately hostile to female rule? I mean, apparently the hostility extends, at least to some degree, from Cleopatra all the way to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and you brought up Hillary Clinton, so I'll go there. Let me make this statement that I think you can agree with, whether you're on the right or the left, that the possible lies of a female candidate are a million times more powerful than the absolute untruths of a male candidate. And the idea that a female becomes this distrustful, duplicitous person is quite interesting to me, and something that I still haven't quite wrapped my head around, though I will lay the blame at the doorstep of what we simplistically see as female emotionality. Hmm. Now, you know, these ups and downs, these mercurial perceived as female ways, you know, this menopausal woman or this PMSing woman, this uncontrollable woman, and the guy is like this even keel thing, right? Now, we've created this binary and we've created the stereotype of the female emotionality, but I would argue it's the reason that we bar women from power so systematically. And until we understand and turn that emotionality to our better interests, I think we'll continue to put obstacles in the way of the female. And by that, I mean, it's the men in society that generally rape and murder and commit violent acts. And it's the men in society who might take a gun to their family and then to themselves and go out in one big grand bang. And it's the lack of emotionality on that stereotypical spectrum that might make a man do that, lack of being in touch with emotions, that touching emotions and feeling what something might be like, connecting with the emotions of others, is exactly what we need to get through the 21st century intact.
You know, I'm just curious about, you know, this idea of Hillary Clinton. Have researchers been able to figure out exactly what the reasons were that American voters ultimately turned away from her and to Donald Trump? I mean, was it emotionality, to use your word, or was it the fact that people simply were tired of the Clintons?
I think in her case, it's a combination of both. So you can throw Hillary Clinton out of it and then look to Elizabeth Warren and look to people saying, well, you know, I like her, but I'm just not sure. She just gives me a bad feeling. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. And so we can transfer this distrust, this gut reaction towards the female to other female candidates and take the Clinton baggage out of the situation entirely. And you can look at Ocasio-Cortez and her youth and her beauty and how that is perceived as potentially threatening. So a woman can't win either way. She's seen as either too alluring and sexy and she's going to make you lose your mind, or she's turned into the crone and she's going to lecture you and berate you and tell you what to do like your mother. And there's no way to win. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I think studies on this from my own limited reading are just being done on what the psychological and sociological knee-jerk reactions are of a populace and their perceptions of females in power, and then where the biological roots of this could potentially be. I think if I go to the evolutionary biology, I see that the survival of a woman is in her nuclear family setting, where the survival of a man in a hunter-gatherer reality is in a much broader, more politically broad setting. And so I think when we see a woman saying she's going to work for all of us, then we might distrust it. We're like, no, no, I know you're just in there for your family and your people and not for me. Whereas the man, we might, just in our guts, in our own synapses, in our own DNA, believe it more. That is not something that cannot be surmounted. We can surmount racism, even though many have argued that that's written into our DNA as well.
I mean, although it is heartening, I've got 20 seconds left, that so many women are running this time for the presidency. It's amazing to me.
It's part of our broadening of a culture and a society, and it shows the economic and political power that women are gaining. And we'll see how the numbers shake out. I mean, I will leave it on a more cynical note that even with this year of the woman that we've just had in the American Congress, we're not at 25% yet.
Right.
And if feminism is nothing more than 50% of the population wanting 50% of the power, we have a bit of a ways to go.
That's Kara Cooney. Her book, When Women Ruled the World, she'll be at the Kauffman Center 7:30 Tuesday evening. For tickets, events.nationalgeographic.com. Kara, thanks so much. Really enjoyed having you.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, did you know there is art that was stolen by the Nazi regime that is housed at Kansas City's Nelson Atkins Museum of Art? We'll talk about it tomorrow. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.